here is the most common mistake I see in leaders and coaches.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. That is what you call a little bit of a teaser of what is to come in this podcast. I am Rob Calder. I will be joined by Nick Mihai a little bit later on in the podcast as well. Thanks very much for tuning in for another week. Of course, you can follow along on the Talking Split socials. So on X, on Instagram, on YouTube, there'll be a new drill that goes up for coaches on every Monday. There'll be a new podcast that drops on every Friday. If there is anything that you would like us to discuss on the podcast or any drills or anything in particular that you would like some assistance with, by all means, shoot us a message, slide into the DM, shoot me an email, whatever I can do to help with that, more than happy to do that in the coaching landscape. So what we're getting into today, really fortunate to be joined for this pod episode by Errol Amorosika. It's a great topic that he dives into today with us around psychological safety in coaching, how to deliver feedback and leadership and culture. So it's a great listen and we'll jump straight into it now. So fantastic to have Errol Amorosika in with us today to talk all things coaching in particular. Errol, thanks very much for jumping in. Do you want to just give us a little bit of a background on who you are and what you do in this space?
Thanks, Rob. Great to be with you all. So my background's originally as a sports chiropractor, believe it or not.
Yep.
So I grew up in Melbourne.
We've probably sent you far too many kids over the years.
Probably over the years, yes. And then finished my university in Melbourne, moved to the Gold Coast, and ran a sports practice up there. So lots of professional surfers, Ironman and women, triathletes. Even got to spend some time with a professional baseball team in the US. And then in the early 2000s, I started noticing a couple of things. The first was that athletes' psychology and mentality were a huge part of their well-being and performance. And the other thing was that their environment, surprisingly enough, contributes to well-being and performance. So being a bit of a nerd, I went and did my psychotherapy qualification and also did a master's degree in the US on organizational change. And started consulting around 2007. And so I phased out the chiropractic stuff and phased in the consulting work. And then in about 2013, I met Pippa Grange, who some of you may have heard of, probably one of the best sports psychs in the world, and people are talking about culture. And our first project was working with the Olympic swim team after the 2012 London Olympics. Around some cultural challenges they had. And we worked together quite a bit. And in 2017, she went to the UK to get a job with the English FA. And I took over Bluestone Edge. So these days, most of my work is in the sporting sector, not only but mostly, specialising probably in culture, leadership and diversity. So I basically work as a consultant, a facilitator and the performance coach. So I love all things coaching, same as you two guys here today.
Yeah, no doubt.
And the technicalities, the challenging of coaching, especially in these days and these times.
I've just got a question. I'm not jumping the gun here. I just want to, because I'm very interested in what you're saying. Can you unpack? You mentioned environment is very important with the player psyche. I haven't butchered what you just said. I hope I haven't, but can you unpack what you mean by environment?
I mean, we could say environment loosely is culture. Mm-hmm. And I think we underestimate the importance of individual talent, work ethic, capability, and overestimate how important those things are. And underestimate the importance of culture and environment from a performance and well-being point of view. So we think how well athletes are performing, engaging, recovering, well-being is an individual thing. And that's obviously important. Don't want to minimize the importance of just basic principles of training and physiology and talent. But I've learned and I've seen time and time again, the biggest determinant of engagement, well-being, performance is culture and environment.
Is that because it's sort of hard to quantify? Like it's easy to know when someone scored 20 points per game and, you know, they've contributed. It's really easy to see it. Is it because culture is a little bit harder to see?
I think culture is harder to see, but it's easier to feel.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's harder to quantify,
yep.
To measure it, as you're saying, Rob.
Yep.
But I think we feel when we feel welcomed and like we belong and like we're valued. And there's such important things around, especially for kids, just engaging in sport and staying engaged in sport, let alone performing at a high level, let alone getting the best out of their talent.
Do you believe there's a blueprint for culture, or do you believe it's ever changing dependent on what team you have because they're individual humans?
I think it's a great question, Nick. I think there are some foundational elements that have to be in place. And then the rest is like the chemistry in the team and the coach's personality and what we believe is important and our values and the challenges we've faced, not just today, but like in the last 5 years. All those things are this mysterious mix and alchemical combination. Yep. That's hard to predict, but that's part of the challenge of coaching and developing good teams.
It's interesting. I was reading something during the week and it was about the Melbourne Storm, who have obviously been the forefront of everything rugby league in Australia for decades on decades now. And you look at the coach as a leader there in Craig Bellamy and everything they do with him. But there was a real – and it was a bit of a tagline of the article because it obviously sticks with you straight away, and it's like, we have a no dickheads policy.
Yep.
And it's just – and that's easy to probably do at that – easier, I suppose, to do at that level because, look, if – someone doesn't fit within their culture, they move on to the next player, and it just, you're always dealing with someone that's very talented, obviously. At junior sport, like, it's our job to stop them from being that in the first place or try and guide them out of going down that road where they might be a problem person, like they've got things going on in their home life, like whatever it might look like. That's where we probably come in as coaches, I feel like.
Exactly. And I think, Rob, you're heading towards a really critical discussion as coaches. I think the role of the coach is changing.
Yep.
And I feel really sorry for coaches because I don't think we've landed on a spot yet. And speaking to coaches is like speaking to teachers these days, where a lot of the traditional tasks that parents have done now get landed on teachers. And I think coaches are very similar. And I think the tension point is, how do we develop coaches and how do we clarify their role in line with these new expectations of society? And then what's reasonable, given most coaches in junior sport are volunteers, there's limited time for coach development. They've just signed up to like coach basketball, and yet they've got to like be these part-time therapists, part-time parents, part-time welfare officers. And that's a real challenge for coaches out there. I think that's also true in elite sport. We're still grappling with, in 2025 and going forward, what's the role of the coach really look like?
Yep. Do you have any thoughts on what the role of the coach is at the moment?
I think it's shifting.
Yep.
I'm not sure where it's going to land.
Yeah.
How far from the traditional, just the tech and the tack. Yeah, you know, I'm the leader, do what I say, kind of mentality versus the other extreme, like being a therapist, being a pastoral care mental health officer.
Yep.
That's maybe too far the other extreme, but that's the direction we're heading in. I think what's most important for coaches' well-being is that as associations and governing bodies, we spend time like, let's just land in a spot for this year. Okay, and then clarify your expectations so they're reasonable. There's duty of care for the people we're looking after in coaching, but coaches know the boundaries of their role, what's in it and what's not in it, and they can just get better at doing that.
Yep.
What skills do you think a coach will need? This is something that Rob's asked for a long time. I ask it too in the community courses and things. What skills? A lot of answers we get is like empathy, honesty. These are from students, by the way, which is really interesting as well. What skills do you believe that a coach needs now, knowing that the role is just changing?
I think empathy is important. I think the skill of seeking first to understand. That's from Stephen Covey.
Yep.
Like if a kid is being an idiot, like let's understand why. Yep. Do they feel insecure, overcompensating, stuff going on at home? Is there a mental health issue we've got to address? I think how we create psychological safety, one of my favorite topics,
yep,
is critical. How we create an inclusive culture, and those last two are linked, is really important. And where I see it shifting is less from the coach as a leader and more as how is the coach a partner with those they're coaching? How is there more of a collaborative spirit,
yep,
with those they're coaching? So from going from coach as a leader, I think the way we're moving towards is the coach as a facilitator.
Yep. No, it makes a lot of sense because, I mean, I'm sort of weighing it up in my head as we're talking about it now. And it's like I think I'm kind of landing on the coach is more of a shepherd. Like it's your job to – you know where you want to get them to, and
yes,
bearing in mind that not everyone in the same team will have the same end point. Like there might be a couple that stop along the way and say, hey,
yes,
I'm content here. But our job is to not hit them with a stick and say, this is what you have to do. Our job is to try and guide them in that direction.
Yes. And as a facilitator coach, they have a say in that direction.
Yep.
Both in the where we want to end up and how do we get there.
Yep.
So how do we engage the people we're coaching going, what do you want to do today? Where do you want to get to?
Yep.
How, okay, last Saturday, our defense wasn't so great. What did you notice? What do you think we can change?
Is this all part of the psychological safety you were talking about? Is that, or is that something different? I've got so many questions, by the way, but I'm just trying to pick one.
That's great. I think, Nick, it's related, but it's different. I think if you really zoom out and go, what's the role of the coach? Is it just the skill development and the tech and the tack? And that's obviously part of it. But is it also to foster love of the game? Is it to use sport as a vehicle to give them life skills? Is it to maximize the chance when they leave sport or continue sport, they're productive citizens who are successful in their own right? And again, what's reasonable for a coach to take on?
Yep.
But I think from a really big picture perspective, that's so important. And that goes all the way up through elite sport.
Yep.
I remember talking to an AFL CEO quite a few years ago, and had done a survey of their men's playing group. And he said, half the men players aren't happy playing AFL.
Yeah, wow.
Now, from the outside, we think, here are these young men. We think they're living the dream.
Yep.
Playing AFL, playing a sport they love, making pretty good money, all the status which comes with that. But half of them are not enjoying that experience, which kind of breaks my heart. They've worked their whole life to get to this spot.
Yep.
They think will make them happy, and then they're playing AFL footy and they're not enjoying the experience.
Is there any reason why? Because that actually shocks me too. Yeah. Like I would have just assumed, hey, you've made it, you've done it. Now you get to progress in the highest level at your sport. Yeah. Was there a reason why?
I mean, it's complex.
Yep.
It's like it becomes a job as opposed to a sport.
Yep.
Now, that love of just kicking the footy around the park with your mates.
Yep.
The shooting hoops on the Asheville court at the school with your buddies gets lost. It's the commodification of athletes. They become bits of meat that get traded around. You're only seen as an athlete, not as a human being.
Yep.
The whole humanity gets like jettisoned because you're now an elite athlete and people just see you as that elite athlete as opposed to a person who's got feelings and vulnerabilities and insecurities. That's all part of it. So if we want to like give athletes an enjoyable experience of sport, however long they're engaged with sport in, how do we provide antidotes for those challenges of it becomes a job or it becomes all I think about, it becomes my whole value is seen as how many points I scored on the weekend. If I scored less points, then my value as a human being goes down.
Yep.
Right. But an issue we have as well is, that's a big one. Fun to work is a big thing in our junior coaching. There are coaches that just treat them like professional athletes when they're just like experiencing the game for the first time or the first few seasons, and they're like, oh, is this it? Is it? It feels like a job. Why do I want to do this outside of a school and things like that?
Exactly. So, yeah. Which comes back to the role of the coach.
Yep.
So if we can agree as sporting bodies that one of the key functions of coaching is to ensure your athletes are enjoying the process from the under 10s here at Dan and on up to NBL teams or national teams, that's a huge part of coaching.
Yeah.
If we can agree a coach's role is to give those athletes from a 10-year-old to a 25-year-old life skills and to teach and to treat those challenging moments as potential life lessons around connection, vulnerability, resilience, problem solving, what a great thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But again, that just puts more load on the coach.
It does. And
more demands and more skill requirements. And yeah. When they're volunteers, where's the balancing point? So I think this is the discussion I think I'm loving having with you two today, because it's like it's so much just up in the air for coaches.
Yeah, and it's funny because I, you know, do the old doom scrolling every now and again where I'm just trying to sort of tune out, and oddly enough, it pings my brain a little bit more to think about various things. And I was watching a talk from a teacher who spoke about, walked into a classroom, saw a child with their feet up on the table and knew there were two ways to approach this. You can walk in there and you can say, take your feet off the table, but immediately conflict. And so as soon as there's conflict, that's going to be a challenging environment for the teacher and for the student, because the student gets kind of put on blast where everyone now looks at them to see, well, what's your reaction when this has happened? Or you can walk in there and say, hey, you got two options here. You can either put your feet on the floor or you can stand up. Your call. And now the student felt a little bit more empowered to make their own decision. And this is, I feel like, kind of the art of coaching. How do we get them to go in a direction we want them to go, but still giving them not the belief that they have a choice in it, but giving them some autonomy, I feel like, is such a powerful part of what they have to do. Because if they don't buy into it, it doesn't really matter what we want them to do in the first place. And I suppose this is the psychological safety. Like, how do we make them feel like they are the most important person on that court when we've got five other people like around and trying to balance all of that?
Yes. And I think with psychological safety, the outcome of that is easy to see. Yep. So athletes, from kids to adults, they'll have more fun. They'll try different things. They'll be more innovative. They'll be more engaged. They'll support their teammates more. It's a great example I saw in AFL this year. I think it was round 8 when Collingwood was playing Geelong, I think, and Jack Crisp had a shot on goal after the siren to win the game. And he missed. And Collingwood lost. And within 3 seconds, he had like 6 guys around him, not just a cursory pat on the back, rub of the head, like genuine love.
Yep.
And I thought, the message that sends is, if you make a mistake, we still love you.
Yep.
That's like an extreme example of psychological safety. Yep. So next time someone's got a shot on goal after the siren or a critical moment in the game, they aren't thinking, if I miss, if I stuff up, are my teammates not going to love me anymore?
Yep.
So that's a great example. Now, how to create psychological safety?
Yeah, that was my next question. Like, because that doesn't just happen.
Doesn't just happen.
Yeah.
And so, again, depending which level we're coaching at, I think talking about what makes us feel safe is a great step. I think we all know when safety levels shift. And one of the misconceptions is that psychological safety is static. Yep. It's actually very fluid and variable. It'll change day to day, hour to hour, even minute to minute, based on people's behaviors.
Yep.
So if we notice the shifts up or down in psychological safety, going, what just happened? Yep. Where safety levels went down. We all got a bit like caught our breath and got a bit anxious. Or what happened when we just felt a bit more relaxed and at ease and connected to each other? Then as a team culture, how do we reward, support those behaviors that increase psychological safety and resist or minimize those behaviors that decrease psychological safety. And that becomes our culture.
Yep.
So we know if someone's speaking, if we cut them off, it's going to decrease psychological safety. If they can speak, increase the psychological safety. If someone's saying, I feel nervous, if that's validated, they go, yep, of course you feel nervous. It's a big game today. It's going to like increase safety. If you go, don't worry about it, get over it. That's going to decrease safety. So all those behaviors we can almost codify.
Yep.
I think a good way to start as well, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm on the right path here, is when a kid has a wide open layup or he's at the free throw line, they miss it. We all see it. It's either the reverse bend from the coach or it's the hand on the knees and drop the head. If you can avoid that, go get a drink of water. I mean, it's very difficult to do because you just sometimes react. That kind of would create a bit of safety of like,
yeah,
you know, kids, I want to try
body language.
Yeah.
Like that's like,
that's what they're reading.
They are astute. It's funny because I'm piggybacking onto that. I reckon players have learnt less from me by my vocal cues and my direction and yes, more from body language.
Yes. Like
they know what I'm thinking before I've said anything.
Like, I actually think it's body language and tone. I think they're the two things. Sometimes, like, if you come into a timeout and go, hey, everyone, just don't panic. Everyone calm down. We're good. Like, my tone is saying, you can say whatever you want, but your tone is saying a very different message. Yep. Like, they're very clever. They pick up on these things.
I think that's really perceptive and insightful. And if I can zoom out, I think, like, as a coach, I always look at those challenges like body language or voice tone as an opportunity for professional and personal development. So if we can't maintain, let's call it positive tone, positive body language, what's happening for us as the coach?
Yeah, we internalize, like we start to look for outlets somewhere. Like you can only internalize so much for so long.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what's our psychology? That's behind that grumpy tone, poor body language? Are we insecure about our role? Are we living vicariously through the people we're coaching? They're all like big questions. But how do we coach ourselves? How do we increase our own self-awareness as coaches?
Can I ask a question? Why do you think it is? It might be a random question.
This is going to be good. I can tell.
Yeah, you know, it's good because
you've been thinking about this for a while.
Yeah. Rob knows when the brain's ticking. It's more about how to ask.
I can see the smoke coming out of your ears
because I've hit my question limit probably. But I was just going to ask, like, why do coaches, and there's a lot of them, want to be? I want to be the hard, tough, disciplinary coach. I want to be the one that has the fittest team. Like, why don't more of those coaches want to be the, you know, I really want to create a great environment for my team? Like, what are they missing? Something? Are they on the wrong path? Are they on the right path, but they need to add something? Like, what do you think?
I mean, that is a great question. It's a complicated credit question. Yeah, thanks, Nick.
Yeah. I've just extended this another hour, everyone.
So. That's fine. I think. Say the question again, Nick. It's such a good question. Please.
Yeah, I just wanted to know why we have a few of our, well, quite a lot of our representative and volunteer coaches that are out in the community, and they want to be the disciplinary coach. They want to be the disciplinary coach. They want to be the hard, tough coach.
Yes.
Because either they feel that players these days aren't as disciplined as they were 10 years ago, things like that. Why is that? Why do you think that is, in your opinion?
In my opinion, there's a couple of reasons. Firstly, what they had modeled to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're an athlete, especially a male athlete, male coach over the age of 40, where you grew up in the 70s and 80s, that was the style of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
You make a mistake, you run suicides.
Mm. Yep.
Right? So that whole Ron Barassi kind of like style of coaching, those Melbourneites and AFL fans. And maybe that worked then, maybe it didn't, I don't know. But that's what they had modeled for them. So they think coaching looks like that. The second point is, we've already talked about this, if we haven't clarified the functions of their role, if they think it's just about scoring points, just about a zone defense, and they don't understand, haven't been supported or educated in this way to see, your role is beyond that these days. It's about psychological safety and developing human beings, not just athletes. It's about inclusion. It's about enjoyment. Then we can't blame the coaches for doing what you said, Nick, because we haven't supported the coaches around what their role looks like and what the expectations of their role are based on what the role actually is from a really high level. So if we say to a coach, yes, do the tech and the tack, that's really important. But equally or more important is you give those kids or young adults a positive experience and empower them to be better people, better citizens with life skills right away. That's going to hopefully change how the coach approaches those moments.
Unfortunately, the scoreboard lies. You can win by 30 points and everyone, how good is that coach? How good is that team? And I think people aspire to be that. And they might have seen a coach that just lucked into a good group of players that do click together and it works really well. But it doesn't necessarily equate to the same outcomes. You can't coach every team the same.
No.
I've learned that over the years my personality has to change depending on who I'm coaching,
exactly.
What I'm coaching. And it's funny because I would feel like I'm fairly loose coaching under 12 kids. Like it's just, do what you want. And, we'll sort of navigate a few things along the way. Whereas I get to 18s and all of a sudden I get really overcomplicated with things because there's this impression that the tech and tack takes over by that stage. And it's like, actually, that's not the reason they're there. They've made a conscious decision by the time they hit under 18s. So what do I actually want this to be? And do I want to go further with my basketball? Sure, there might be two or three kids in your team that really have that aspirational goal, I think, to move past that. But the vast majority of your group are there socially. Like they want to be there.
Exactly.
They've made a conscious decision. This is where I want to be because this is a fun environment. This is a welcoming environment. I feel safe here talking to your psychological safety before. That's why they want to be there. And how often do we take that away as a coach? Because we do. We slump the shoulders or we throw a whiteboard or we yell at someone across a court and we take away that joy from them.
That's great, Rob. That's true. And the scoreboard lying, we could win by 30 points every game.
Yep.
And after the season, half the kids drop out of sport.
Yep.
Or worse, change teams.
Yep.
So yes, you had scoreboard success and you might have won the grand final that year, but then half the kids drop out of sport. Yep. So if our role is to keep kids engaged in sport because they're having fun, then how does that change how as coaches we take up our role?
Yep.
And what do we value?
Yeah, and I suppose one of the questions I get asked a fair bit whenever we're taking courses is the discipline side of things because there is – we certainly push the child safety message hard.
Yes.
At every single course we go and run, it is all about keeping the kids safe in the sport. But there's it's not even the danger. I've got no way of wording this really well, so I'm just going to blurt it out and we'll figure it out afterwards.
That's fine.
But it's almost like I remember growing up, I did fear a couple of my coaches and that kept me on very much, hey, I know what I have to do because there is a little bit of fear involved with what I have to do because if I don't do it well, there will be repercussions. Now, whether the repercussions were you don't play as much as you used to, your team doesn't win, whatever it might be. Has the pendulum swung so far the other direction now where we're so super conscious about keeping everyone safe, healthy, happy that we've almost lost the ability to give direction when we need to give direction?
I think a little bit, yes.
Yep.
And both extremes are problematic.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Valid.
So the fear-based coach, that might create discipline when you're with that coach.
Yep.
But then you leave the basketball stadium and that fear factor that coach isn't there going, I can run riot now.
Yep.
At school with my mates, at home, no fear factor, and I'm going to make bad decisions.
Yep. True.
Right. The other extreme where there's just no discipline and no boundaries and no repercussions, that just teaches kids to not have any boundaries. And we all need boundaries and limitations. Right. The middle ground is, as I said previously, is that coach as a facilitator. So as an example, right, you might say, hey, Rob, last week's game, what do you think your defense was like? What did you notice was good, what was bad? Yeah, Errol, I noticed my – I was too high on my stance.
Yep.
I was out of my position. Great. Good you noticed that, Rob. Like, how come? You're normally really good at those things.
Yep.
Let's unpack that together.
Yep.
I have an example of it. I think I've said it on the pod before, but it's relevant to here. But I had a player, very good player, who one of the games he didn't play the entire second half. Was quite hard on him, but at the end of the game, before he left, I go, hey, organise with your mum. I'm going to catch up with you before training. So I got onto him before it escalated out of control. And then when I sat down with him in the meeting, I go, look, mate, I really want to compete. I really want to beat these teams. I can't do it without you. So we're going to write down what you think I need to help you with [S2] Wow. [S1] Or run in order to get you there. What are you comfortable with? And as soon as he said it to me, these are the things that I really like to run. This is how I help. Beautiful. I'll need some of these things from you though in order for me to tick these things off. And it's kind of like having a little bit of discipline. Like I don't condone benching someone for the second half. I think that was an error on my part in fairness, in reflection, which is something I did tell him as well. But I think you've got to figure out a way to go, these are the boundaries, but you have say within these boundaries as well. You've got to find that kind of balance, I guess.
And what you model there beautifully, Nick, is number one, the boundaries, as you've already said, but that more collaborative, facilitative style of coaching where it's a conversation, it's a partnership as opposed to a dictatorship.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think especially with these younger generations, they're more into partnerships and collaboration than authority figures.
Yep.
So we have to change how we coach because the old school dictator fear factor coach isn't going to fly.
No.
But we still need boundaries and limitations and what's okay and what's not okay from a cultural point of view. So, but how do we facilitate those discussions where people feel heard and seen and valued? Now, the research says that for people to engage, all they need is to feel heard and valued. That's the meme will go in that direction. You might go, you know what? Thanks for sharing that. I'm okay with two-thirds of that, but the last third, I'm going to push back and go, let's do it my way for these reasons. Okay. Most people are fine with that. Most people aren't attached to what they want. They just want to be heard and valued for their perspective and their needs. And if you explain why we're going in a different direction, most reasonable people are happy with that, even kids. So again, that's that facilitative style of coaching where how do we engage them, bring them on the journey, but still hold authority of our role to go, you know what, love what you're saying, great idea, thanks for suggesting it, we're going to go this direction instead. How do you feel about that? Okay, cool, I'm good with that. So that's a whole new skill set we're asking coaches to embrace and develop that to the best of my knowledge, I'll check in with you guys as I'm asking this, isn't in coach development at this point in time.
Getting there, but it's not. It's not a staple, I would suggest, at this stage. We're trying to get coaches more in the lens of ask questions rather than give answers.
That's a great start.
Because that is one, showing awareness of if I'm going to ask a question, I've clearly seen something that is going to prompt me to ask a question, but it then leads into a bit of a relationship where there's some back and forth. And, you know, we deal with kids of all shapes, sizes, personalities, and everything else in between. You'll have the very outlying extroverts, which bounce into your session, and everyone knows they're in your session. Like, they're everywhere. Then you get the really shy, quiet, introvert type kids that are just like, hey, I like playing, I like being here, but I'm not out there. So how do you connect with those kids? Because the extroverts are easy. Like they'll force you to connect with them. But the introverts are harder. Like they take a little bit longer. There's got to be trust before they'll even open up to you.
And we did a little bit of a workshop on it at the CMC and we came with a simple question just to start the conversation. It's easy for any coach. What did you see?
Nice.
That's it. That'll start because it's such an open question. I saw a player in the corner, player on the dot. Beautiful. Now we've got something. Yep. Let's start asking questions
about
it.
And even how you respond to that though, like as a coach, like even if they give you something that it's like, oh, I don't know that you've seen what I really wanted you to see. It's like, hey, that's good. What else?
Nice.
Like, so you hear it straight away, but now you try and shift their focus. Okay, it's not wrong. Maybe there's something else because, it's they want to be heard. They want to be validated. They want to be know that you're in the trenches with them when things aren't going perfectly in that space. So I think that's a really valuable part of it, because, I mean, your other area of expertise is obviously feedback, and there is not a basketball coach alive at the moment or any junior sports coach that is not being asked for feedback regularly on their players.
Yes.
What does good feedback look like, sound like, feel like, and how does it compare to, say, really bad feedback?
I mean, if I go back half a step, Rob, to your comment about extroverts, for example, I often think, like with extroverts, connecting with them superficially is easier.
Yep, great point. Yep.
Right. But sometimes that deeper connection with extroverts can be harder than the introverts.
Yep.
Because often introverts are the more sensitive, deeper feeling kind of people, right? So if you gain trust and rapport, there's a deeper connection there. Extroverts can be a little bit like flighty sometimes. It's like, right, so how do we like, love all the stuff you're telling me and you really engage, but how did you really feel about that? What did you really think about that? Let's go a step deeper. So how do we not get fooled by the illusion of extroversion? There isn't a deeper feeling, deeper thinking process happening under the surface of that extroverted person, and only see me as the extrovert as opposed to also a potentially a sensitive, deeply reflective, deep thinking kind of person.
Yep.
Right. So that's another skill to develop.
True.
As coaches. So feedback.
Yep.
I think constructive feedback is the most effective tool for aligning behavioral performance, cultural expectations. And we just don't do it, or we feel really uncomfortable doing. And I think what good feedback looks like is actually based on what the athlete does in response to our feedback. There's no right or wrong feedback if the athlete stays engaged.
Okay, yep.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, I like that.
So if we're doing a good job, the athlete or the person won't get defensive, right? They'll engage in the feedback. They can integrate, implement the feedback into their role.
Gotcha.
They can take responsibility for what they haven't done so well. Yep. They can celebrate what they have done really well. They're the outcomes of good feedback.
Yeah.
Are we talking, because when I think about feedback, I think about two different things. There's live feedback, which is on the court, and there's feedback where you sit down and go through, is it for each of them, is there such thing as too much feedback?
It depends on the athlete.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. So if it's athlete-centric, mm-hmm. where's the athlete max out around the information, given the context? So on a game day, you obviously can't on-court feedback be doing a whole like 5-minute feedback. It's like, you know, Johnny, X, Y, Z.
Mm.
Right. And people think good feedback starts when you meet with the athlete and then give good feedback. Yep. I think good feedback starts way before that. So how have we built psychological safety in the lead up to feedback, giving feedback? And how have we fostered a growth mindset? Because without those two things, no matter what you do, it's not going to land super great.
Yep. No, that makes sense. And like I'm thinking back now of some of the coaching I've done over the years, and there have been times where I've gone to deliver feedback. The players put their hand up and like, hey, I know what you're about to say before you come and deliver this.
Yep.
And I've probably doubled down on that. I'm like, well, I know, but you've got to hear it anyway. Like it's got to come again. And it's like, did I really need to do that? If they've already self-reflected to the point where they've realized it themselves, I've now made it confrontational by saying, I know you know, but I need to tell you anyway. And that's gone too far in one direction.
Exactly.
Like our goal is to make our players aware. Like we probably want to make ourselves a little bit redundant as coaches. I would suggest. Like we want to build our players up to the point where they can recognize problems, find solutions, identify feedback loops for themselves without us having to tell them that. But we've got to try and build that from the ground up. They can't do that without us either. Like our job is to try and build the foundation before they get to that point, I suppose.
Yes.
So is there a is feedback better off in the moment, or is it better off with some air between the two? Like, is there
air between?
Like, just some time. Like, does that help to sort of say, hey, look, something's gone wrong. I'm just going to leave this for a little while before I come back to it?
I think it's all context development.
Yep.
Context dependent, rather.
Yeah, okay.
And then that's the art of coaching.
Yeah.
When does this require, like, on-the-spot feedback?
Yep.
When is a bit of air between the performance and the feedback justified and helpful?
Yep.
And I think around doing ourselves out of a job, I think like that negates the growth mindset.
Yep.
There's always improvement to be made, a continuous improvement mentality, right? So no matter how good our athletes, our team is, we can always get better. And as a coach, that's our job. How do we take them to the next level?
Yep.
As a team, as individual athletes, as human beings. So we always have a job, Rob, I think, right?
Oh, always, yeah. If it's not one thing, it'll be another. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, very quickly. Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's great for Rob and myself as well.
You guys, pretty good job security, you two guys, exactly, right? So I think like how we see our role as coaches as that facilitator of continuous improvement.
Yep. Yeah, okay. So is there anything coaches need to be aware of when delivering feedback? So we're talking tone of voice, body language, where they position themselves, because we've always sort of had the little bit of a theory of try and get to eye level with your players if you can. You don't want to talk down to.
Yes.
I've always sort of had the opinion of if you can stand next to them rather than like face to face with them, that takes away a few of the fear, I suppose, for lack of a better term, of being talked at rather than being talked with. Is there anything else that can really work?
I think all those things are critical. Here is the most common mistake I see in leaders and coaches with feedback. They miss the moment that the person they're giving feedback to kind of glazes over.
Okay, yep.
Right. Mm. So if we unpack that from a neuroscience point of view.
Yeah.
This is my nerdiness coming out. Is that the part of our brain that makes decisions, regulates emotions, can take on information and integrate that is the prefrontal cortex. When we experience threat, the part of our brain called the amygdala fires up and basically hijacks the prefrontal cortex. So in that moment, we're going to fight or flight. And in fright or flight, our only priority is survival. It's a hardwired into our nervous systems. The prefrontal cortex goes offline. We literally lose our minds. So our ability to take on information, take on feedback, integrate that feedback is almost zero. We're just thinking, I'm under threat. How do I get out of here? Now, while the coach can do a really good job of being non-threatening, we all have past experiences from that horrible teacher at grade five, the horrible coach in, you know, under 10s, right? With a little, like, let's call them psychological wounds.
Yep.
And subconsciously we go, oh, that feedback Rob's giving me, this is all subconscious. That's like that coach in grade five.
Yep.
And there's the threat. And then we go into fight or flight in a split second. And then we glaze over. So there's four responses to the threat: fight, flight, freeze, or appease.
Okay. Hadn't heard the last two before.
Yep.
Oh, my brain's spinning.
Right. So yeah, but you'll see.
He's in flight.
I'm in flight. Yeah. I'm half out that door.
But you'll see kids, just their face gets frozen.
Yep.
Right? Or they'll go, yeah, coach, no worries, coach, whatever you say, coach. That's the appease.
Yep.
Whatever you say, I'll do, just to like get you out of my face. Yep. The threat's removed.
Is there a way around that, or is it once they've hit that phase,
It's just noticing.
Yep.
Wow. No, in psychology terms, it's called dissociation.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, no, it's out of body experience. They're checked out. Yep. So if we keep giving feedback beyond that point, it's actually abuse.
Yeah. Okay.
Because that kid isn't present to like defend himself. It magnifies an already pre-existing power asymmetry.
Yeah, right.
So as coaches, we have a lot of power because of our position, right?
Yep.
And status. If we miss that moment of dissociation, that kid's power, even the adults,
yep,
even like with grown successful athletes, I've seen this happen, where because of like their own experience of education and coaching in the past, they get triggered, it's a common word these days, in common vernacular, they get triggered into these trauma states or into like these fight or flight moments, and they can't take their own side. Yeah, right. So it magnifies a power asymmetry that's already there.
Yep.
Far out.
And that's when feedback goes down the toilet and people get hurt, and the athlete has a bad experience, goes, don't want feedback ever again. The coach goes, that sucked, don't want the feedback ever again, and nothing changes.
Wow. Okay. That was a lot.
That was a lot. And I'm still processing. Is there a way to do some work before you go into that feedback to not get them to that point? Like you can prepare them for feedback, or is it just once they hit it?
Both, Nick.
Yeah.
So psychological safety helps.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That reduces the threat levels.
Yep.
But once you hit that spot, it's going, okay, wow, maxed out. Okay, let's just stop here. Have a breath.
Psychological safety in the same category as like trust. Is that what we're talking about with psychological safety when you come to feedback?
I think psychological safety helps trust.
Okay.
It kind of like lubricates a deeper conversation.
Mm.
But once athletes hit that dissociation moment, if you keep the feedback process going, there's greater chance of harm. Mm.
So what do you do? Let's say you're in a meeting because – yeah, I'm just processing this right now. Let's let's say you hit that feedback loop or fight or flight.
Yep.
Like, what do you do? Like, obviously, you don't just stand up and walk out the room, but like.
No. So you'd say, hey, Nick, I noticed you just got a bit overwhelmed, right?
Yep. That's true, yeah.
Let's stop the feedback process here, okay? I'm going to stay with you, but let's just take a few breaths.
Yeah, okay. So you just go, hey, we're going to remove ourselves from the
feedback process, right?
Yep.
And help them, if you can, to down-regulate their nervous system.
Yeah, gotcha.
Get them out of fright or flight. So stuff like take a few breaths, like notice like your feet on the ground, notice your bum on the chair.
Okay.
Like become aware of your body, notice your breath, like mindfulness stuff.
Grounding.
Yeah. Grounding, mindfulness stuff.
So don't move on like it's, we're talking about this, you're not doing this well, they've hit fight or flight. And then don't move to another thing.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, cool.
Because it just won't go in their brains.
Yeah.
Because the brain's literally out to lunch.
So it's not about
not the- literally, but it's like the brain's words. Like offline.
Yeah. It's not about the words. It's about what mindset you're in.
They've gone into a fright or flight mode.
Yep.
And until you like ground them, down regulate their nervous system, nothing you say is going to like land.
Yeah. Really interesting.
Is there a, I mean, there probably isn't a percentage number, but is there a sort of guide as to how much positive feedback versus constructive feedback? Like, has it changed over the decades with kids coming through now? Because I feel like this current generation of young player under the age of 18 want far more positive feedback than they do constructive feedback, whereas 20 years ago it felt like everyone wanted the constructive feedback and no one really cared about the positive.
It's an interesting point. I mean, the research says like 7 positives to 1 constructive.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
And the old poo sandwich that we used to talk about as well. That's the old classic.
Yep.
Again.
7 to 1.
7 to 1 is the old
That's
research.
That's way higher than I thought it was.
Yes.
It used to be but, 2 to 1, really.
Yeah.
But again, I think every kid is different.
Yep.
And I don't want to say it's 4 to 1 or 3 to 1.
Yep.
I think the art of coaching is knowing each kid or each athlete and going, here's an athlete who just wants constructive feedback.
Yep.
How do I deliver that in a compassionate, direct, empowering way? This other person needs way more positive feedback and understanding the reasons why.
Yep.
Now, if that young person grew up in a house where there was never like positive validation, they could be starved for life.
Yeah, they're searching for it.
Searching for it, right? Yeah. So before they can even take on constructive feedback, you're going to go, you did this really well, you did this really well, you did this really well, you did this really well. Hey, Rob, just really celebrate those things. Good job, my friend.
Yep.
High five, fist bump, congratulations. You've improved so much in the last 3 weeks. And by the way, just one little thing on the side. Yep. that defensive move you made where you're out of position. Let's just work on that for next week.
Yep. So what I feel, and I have no data to support this, right? So it's just based off
feelings
me
are good.
Coaching. I'm just throwing stuff out there. That's what Rob told me to do, and I am. And so
anecdotally is always good.
Yeah, beautiful. I feel like it's not that kids don't want constructive feedback. They want it. They want a change in how the constructive feedback is delivered. So not necessarily they want positive. They just want it in a different way. To for me, when I was playing, it was if you heard nothing from me, great job. If not, I'm going to tell you about it. Whereas that's now changed, right? Like how they get it. And I think how they get constructive feedback is changing more than whether they want it or not.
I think you're 100% spot on, Nick. And again, for those of a certain generation, how it looked 20 or 30 years ago, inverted commas, constructive feedback. What you're saying, it looks very different in a best case scenario in 2025. Again, that's the challenge of coaching.
Yep.
Now, are we supporting coaches not just to give constructive feedback, but how to tailor the way they give constructive feedback to individual athletes or the team as a whole? That's a huge skill set.
Yep.
That takes a lot of, like, not just self-awareness, but how can you read the signals coming back at you, especially those non-verbal body language signals, the rolled eyes, the checking out, the flush faces, the dissociation states, the fright or flight states. Mm. How can you read that as well as what the athletes are saying? And then tweak according, tweak on the run as you need to. Wow, they're all checking out. They're all looking blank. Okay, I'm too intense. Dial it down a notch, Errol.
Yep, makes sense.
It's funny too, because like with coaches, we also throw into the mix what you were just talking about, that coaches have that ego floating around in the background, which is you got to let go a little bit of it to do this stuff. That's really difficult. You're in a position of power. A lot of the times you have like a certain amount of respect within the community or your club. It's very difficult to undo a lot of that as well, yeah.
And I think, Nick, that's the professional and personal growth of our coaches. Like, if you're just there for a power trip, I want to support you to go, wow, in your life, you must have felt powerless somewhere, right? Let's unpack that with you and resolve that, you know, that last boss who just berated you. Let's do some work around that so you feel more powerful in yourself. You don't need to then have a power trip on the basketball court. Because one way to do it is just to like repress or like manage that power trippiness, right? Mm. That's one strategy. Not sure how sustainable that is.
Yep.
But a much more sustainable growth mindset-y approach is to go, wow, where in your life have you felt powerless? And to normalize that, go, of course, you feel powerless in A and B and C contexts, put you in a position of authority in the basketball court, you're going to go on a power trip. I would too.
Yep. Mm.
That was my background or history.
Yep.
So how do we not shame that person?
Yeah.
Right? But normalize, support, validate their functional need to have power, but develop the awareness to understand where it comes from and then change the story, change their internal narrative around their sense of powerlessness from previous experiences. And they go, yep, I'm in my position of authority as a coach. How do I use my power really well?
Yep.
How do I have clean power, not dirty power?
Yep. It's really the more work you do on yourself, the better you grow as a coach, right? Like, I know it sounds so simple, almost stupid-like, but that's the truth, right? The more...
It's nothing truer was ever spoken, Nick. Yeah. Now, and I say, better people make better athletes, I say all the time.
Yep.
Better people make better coaches. Yep. Now, certainly as me as a coach, as a performance coach, like the more I like accept myself, the more I understand myself and have empathy for myself, and I have compassion for myself and my own experiences and insecurities, I'm a way better coach when I'm coaching other people.
Yep. Mm. And it's funny. I think that that ability to show a little bit of vulnerability as a coach to your players as well goes such a long way. Because, and we were talking about this just the other day, Nick, like I was on court not too long ago, was doing something and screwed it up. Like I put the player in the wrong spot. Like it wasn't how it was supposed to go. And the second, and you could see the players were on edge because I think they noticed that I'd mucked it up as well and didn't want to say anything. I'm like, hold on, I've made a mistake here. That's on me. That's my fault. You're supposed to be over there instead of where you are. And you just saw like the entire room just took a breath out.
Exactly.
And it was just like, oh, it's okay. Like they were nervous about telling me. And it's like, hey, don't worry about that. I'm bulletproof. Like you can tell me whatever you want. I'm fine.
Yes.
But it was almost that ability to show, hey, I make mistakes as well.
Yes.
You're going to make mistakes. Just own your mistake. Acknowledge it. Fix it where you can fix it and move on from it. That's what makes it a little bit easier, I think. But you have to lead that.
Rob, can we unpack that for a second?
Yeah.
It's such a great example. So the breath out you noticed,
yep.
That's psychological safety going up.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Right. So, wow, the breath out, we'll relax a bit more. Anxiety, tension comes down a bit. That's an increase in psychological safety.
Yep.
Now we go, what happened to increase that psychological safety? Rob showed some vulnerability.
Yep.
Right. So in this team, with this group of kids or adults, whoever you were coaching, a bit of vulnerability is going to increase psychological safety, yep. Which is often the case, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
Right? And what you've done is you've given them permission to do the same, yep. Right? You can tell them, you know, be open, be vulnerable, and that's going to have some traction. But the moment you model it as the leader,
yep.
It gives them permission to do the same thing. They go, oh, we can admit the mistakes too, right? That makes your feedback job so much easier.
Yeah.
That one little thing you did going, yep, I messed up. It creates a culture where messing up is okay. Admitting you messed up is okay. And every time you do that, go, yep, I messed up, you're laying down one more brick of psychological safety, specifically around, if you narrow it down, it's okay to mess up and own up to it. And every time you do that, those kids feel a bit more permission to do it themselves.
Yeah. And there obviously comes a point where you don't want to make mistakes. Like game on the line, you want to be, like you talked about the AFL football before,
yes.
You don't want to make that mistake. But every mistake will get you one step closer to success because you've been in that repetition before. You've seen that, you know, it's played out multiple times over the course.
Yes.
And that's where you want to get to, I guess, as a coach.
Absolutely. And the only way to learn from mistakes to get better is as a coach or as an athlete is to go, yep, I made a mistake.
Yep.
And let's unpack that.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
Just recognize it even first.
Recognize it, yeah. Acknowledge it, and then go, is it a skill thing? Is it an execution thing? Is it a composure or a pressure thing? Is it a strategy thing? Didn't know my role thing? All the above, right? But to unpack and learn from it, you have to first go, it's okay to admit to it, right?
Yep.
And you modeling, I made a mistake, goes such a long way as a coach to giving your athletes permission to going, made a mistake, coach. Great, let's talk about it. What can we learn from that?
Yep.
I got a question again.
You
know it's time.
I'd expect been a while. Nothing. I thought I could smell the smoke, Nick.
You could, yeah. You could see me just.
I'm going to word up, this. Yep.
I've dubbed these coaches the I know coaches. So if you're giving feedback to a coach, we have coaches out there, not all of them, but they're whatever feedback you give them, oh yeah, I know that already. How do you address that? Do you, like, because you don't want to create conflict and go, well, you don't know because you didn't do it in the gap. Like, you don't want to be in that mode.
Yep.
Like, how would you address that to try and help them? Are they understanding and you can just leave it and let them say, I know? Like, is it a safety mechanism? Are they shutting it down? Because it's something that I've seen over the years as a DOC.
Yes. I think you've already half answered your own question, Nick, by going, are they just insecure? Are they shutting it down? Are they in denial? They're the key questions to start off with. And I would say to them, hey, maybe you know it, maybe you don't. But I first want to understand, help me understand your thinking behind saying, yeah, I got it.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Right? Help me. I'm not denying you've got it, but help me understand your thinking, your feeling behind what you just said of having it, of knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then if you get some engagement around that, you could say, okay, let's say you got it. How is what that thing you reckon you've got, is that reflected in your athletes? What are the behaviors you're noticing or not noticing which confirms or challenges the fact that you've got it? Because if I'm seeing a bunch of athletes who are happy, engaged, learning, growing together, feel included, feel valued, yeah, you got it. If I'm seeing a bunch of athletes who are just scared of you and playing out of fear, and after last year, half the kids dropped out and changed teams, maybe you haven't got it.
Well, and you've hit on a really interesting one here. And you sort of mentioned before, if kids don't return, maybe you're not doing that solid a job as a coach. We've seen the white line fever coaches.
Yes.
That are super calm, friendly, happy, talking before and after the game. But the second the game starts, it just escalates out of nowhere. How do we help those coaches? Like, do they need, would they be aware of it? Are they maybe not aware? Do they go to a different state altogether? Like, is it back into fight? Like, what is it? Like, how do we help?
I think it's, that's the first question. How do we help you?
Yeah.
Like, what happens for you when you're this really loving, caring, gentle person before the game, whistle blows, and you just become this like beast?
Yep.
Like, what happens for you? Do you notice the change in your physiology and your psychology and your demeanor? Yep. That's the first step. And do you want to change? Is that troubling to you? That's that coach you become once the whistle blows. Is that achieving the outcomes you want to achieve? Both in terms of performance and engagement and the kids having a great time. So it's almost like being direct,
yep,
but engaging them in the conversation first, which again comes back to that, you know, the coach is a facilitator. If we're coaching the coaches, how are we facilitating their process?
Yep.
How are we deepening in a non-threatening, non-judgmental, compassionate way? How are we increasing their self-awareness of their own behavior, yep, mentality, physiology, psychology? And then saying, is these the outcomes you want? And if they are, well, either great or let's challenge those outcomes. Yep. If they aren't the outcomes, how do we support you to change those outcomes? Because there'll be a story behind that person, right?
Yeah, of course. Yep. Has to be something has that to has be something. Made them up to be
exactly
where they are. Yep.
None of these behaviors happen in the vacuum.
Yep.
I was one of those coaches when I first started. I openly admit it. And it really came from a very quick success because I had a very good team. It wasn't necessarily like I just inherited this team. They were exceptionally good and there was an expectation, hey, this guy is going to win many, many games. So with that expectation, you build up that white line fever. And it took me a while to work through that. It probably was trusted coaches, mentor coaches, when they would watch my games, go, hey, you got to figure out a way through this, was a big one.
And what helped you, Nick, shift your approach apart from mentor coaches, but what helped you to buy into that change process itself?
Change the goalposts, understand that you do lose games, reflect on like that's just normal part of life, and then what are my goalposts? Well, I want more kids to play higher than me. And then as soon as you do that, you're not riding a referee over a Friday night game anymore.
Great. So as a If I be a coach in a second, mm-hmm, for a second, what I saw you do then was you clarified your role and then clarified the bigger purpose of your role and then asked yourself, what have I got to change to fulfill, to honor the higher purpose of my role? How am I doing, Nick?
I think you're going to get a lot of job offers from the DOC department.
Yeah, right? Not in chiropractic.
Not in chiropractic. Right. So that's what you did. So for you in your development, going, yeah, this is actually my role. There's a higher purpose of my role than just the tech and the tack. and then aligning your behavior and your growth to the higher purpose of that role helped you shift. Now, what I'm passionate about is how many coaches need that, exactly that process. How many coaches out there need support through no fault of their own?
Yeah.
Just regular folks doing the best they can,
yep.
but need support to align their role to a higher purpose, to clarify that higher purpose and what that role looks like to deliver that purpose, and then have the support to develop the skills, the strategy, the coaching skills to do that higher purpose, which would make their experience so much more meaningful and fulfilled.
Yep.
Yeah, your village is really important. Like, I was very lucky that I had a very good village around me as well, as you go through.
Yeah,
well, and it's fascinating. Yeah. You look at like Dunning-Kruger as an example, and it's amazing how many times you ask a coach, hey, do you want to coach? I can't do that. It's like, hey, jump in, we'll support you, we'll give you some assistance. All right, no worries. And they have some really instantaneous success where they have wins, and you go to offer them help and they go, no, I'm good now. Like, I've got this. And it's like, you don't realize what's coming for you. Like, there's going to be this massive drop off at some point where all of a sudden it all falls, you know, because it just happens that way. The ebbs and flows of coaching, like, we all get it.
Yes.
But it is just that ability to know that, hey, the highs are not always that high, the lows are not always that low, and you'll frequently bounce between the two of them within one game, potentially.
And if they see I've had success, had a few wins as the ultimate success, we haven't done a good enough job clarifying their role.
Yeah, great point.
Right? Yep. So we go, winning's great, developing kids' talent is great, making sure your professional athletes are growing, that's great. But here's the higher purpose, what we were about at Basketball Victoria, at this association or this club or Basketball Australia.
Yep.
Here's the higher purpose of coaching. He's like the spirit of coaching, if you like.
Yep.
Darren Best, who he was our performance coach here, he's now at West Memphis, I think it is.
Yep.
He told me that if I ever interview for senior teams, to ask them what the goalposts are straight away. Because, like, we want you to develop these players to move into here, or you want me to win it, because that's it's two different teams.
Yep. And it's difficult.
Yeah.
Because everyone will have it. Like,
both, right?
Well, if you were to ask a board of five people, three will say one, two will say the other, and it might flip depending on who's, like, in those roles.
Yeah.
Like, it's
then you'll say, you all agree, come back to me with a clear role. Because, and I think when we get mixed message as a coach, right, that messes with our heads. So when I'm doing, like, executive coaching, before I actually start the coaching per se, at the start of the session, what do you want to work on? What's your goal for this session? I don't start till I'm really, really clear on that. Because that gives me my job for the session, right? So until I'm really clear, what do you want out of me for this 1 hour? What's the outcomes you want? I don't start the coaching session. Now that can be extrapolated out to a whole season. As a coach for this team for this year, what do you want out of me? Help me do my job better by clarifying my role. So just to win the premiership, I can do that.
Yep.
But if it's to, like, grow and develop kids and love of the game and life skills, I can do that too with some support potentially.
Yeah.
But help me get clear in my job. Otherwise, coaches, we're just setting them up for failure or to feel like failures because we haven't clarified their role.
So they try to do both.
Or be all things to all people and do a good job of none of them and feel bad about them and then drop out of coaching because we haven't supported them to, like, narrow what are two or three things this season you want me to achieve with this team.
I really like that. I'm really conscious of time more than anything else. If there was one bit of sage advice that you could give to all coaches out there in the coaching space, what would you go with?
Great question. I would say do what it takes for you to find meaning and fulfillment and purpose in your role.
Gee, that's deep.
Far out. Yeah, that's...
When you eventually finish coaching, I promise you it won't be the amount of games you won, the premierships you won. Ask any elite athlete, they'll say the same thing, right? I'm imagining you'll want to go, have a 40-year-old in the shops going, coach, you changed my life. I was going through a hard time at school with my parents and you were there for me. You changed my life. You were my backstop. You didn't even know it.
Yep.
Right? They're the moments you want as a coach. When 5 years, I'm getting emotional talking about it, you know.
I think it's hitting on both of us as well.
It's bang on.
Right? They're the moments I think coaches want. We coach because we want to make a difference.
Yep.
Mm. Right? We want to like engage people and grow people and, you know, touch people's lives.
Yep.
Right? And we get caught in this like capitalistic, competitive, got to win a game, got to score so many points. And we get brainwashed thinking that's what success is. And that's part of success. Yep. But to have a really meaningful, fulfilling coaching career, find what really gives you that purpose and meaning beyond the tech and the tack and the score, and find ways to like honor that and grow that and in the way you coach.
Brilliant. Errol, thank you so much. How can people see and read and hear more of you?
Well, my website's Bluestone Edge. I've got a YouTube channel called At The Edge, Lessons in Culture and Leadership. Yep. All sorts of stuff. But thanks. It's been great. No. What a great conversation. I want to thank you both. It's such a great conversation.
We don't forget that, so we very much appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you very much
great,
for coming in.
And great questions. And
I'm still speechless. I'm trying to say something, but I'm still processing everything.
No, brilliant. Errol, thank you so much for your time. Good luck with all your work, obviously, in the basketball space and moving forward. And looking forward to connecting with you in the future.
Likewise. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Massive thanks to Errol for jumping into the podcast this week. So many great takeaways there, I think, that can help us all with our coaching and what we do in this space. We understand it, that we are volunteer coaches by and large that are involved in the betterment of the sport for the people that we deal with. And if we can be just 1% better as a coach and we can make it a better experience and environment for all of our players, that's going to leave the sport in such a better spot moving forward. So a massive thank you to Errol from Bluestone Edge. You can go and have a look at his YouTube channel as well. We'll put it in the show notes for anyone that wants to have a little bit of a look there. But massive thanks to him for jumping in. Thanks everyone for listening once again this week. And we will catch everyone on the podcast again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.